Well, it's lovely to be with you. I left Southampton in 1992, so it's been 19 years since I last lived in Southampton. And, I came and preached here 3 years ago, but it's lovely to be back again. And, good to see, old faces, familiar faces. You know what I mean. It never comes out quite right. But it's lovely to see those I know and love and see lots of new faces as well. And I bring with me the greetings, the love of Amy Park Chapel. Believers to meet there, and it's been very good to. I've known your pastor for years, and as much as when I went to the Barrett Fifth Conference, we used to play football. He was a better footballer than I was, and we used to meet every year on the football pitch. And Roy's always come here, and we're delighted to be able to come preach to them in part. Well, please come with me to the reading which we had, Psalm 32,
page 560. Now, David Cameron, our Prime Minister, has announced that he wants to measure the nation's well-being, sort of happiness survey. And questions are expected to focus on things like health, and marriage, and friendship, and of course whether or not you feel happy. And already there are some sample questions, so hold your breath. You need to rate your answers on a scale of 1 to 10. Okay, these are the questions that people are going to be asked. Overall, how satisfied are you with life nowadays? Overall, how happy did you feel yesterday? Overall, how anxious did you feel yesterday? Overall, to what extent do you feel the things you do in your life are worthwhile? Well, I bet there won't be any questions like this. Have you been forgiven by God? Has your sin been sorted out? Will you be acquitted at the judgment? Because when it comes to real happiness, another David tells us that these are the questions to ask. Verses 1 and 2. Blessed is he whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man whose sin the Lord does not count against him, and in whose spirit is no deceit. So did you hear that? It says blessed or happy. Happy is he. You want to be happy? Spend our lives, don't we, looking for happiness. In our heart of hearts, we don't desire anything else. But where is happiness to be found? And David answers, it is found in being forgiven by God. And David should know. We have three things to say. And the first is this, real happiness. Now, David is king of Israel. He's the man who writes, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. But David has changed. He's now living far from God. That's 2 Samuel chapter 11, we read these words. In the spring, at the time when the kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained in Jerusalem. When David should have been out serving the Lord, he's freewheeling downhill. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. So when he should have been busy doing what God had given him to do, David is dossing in bed, accountable to no one. And feeling bored, he takes a little walk on the palace roof. And for the first time today, or maybe the first time in a long time, excitement. From the roof he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. And in that moment he forgets God. In that moment he becomes an idolater. He's thinking to himself, what will make me happy? Pleasing God or pleasing myself? And he does his arithmetic. What do I want? What will make me happy? And David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, and the wife of Uriah the Hittite? In that moment, David wants Bathsheba more than he wants God. His universe becomes one woman. Or we should say, his universe becomes one body shape. That's all he wants. And so we read, David sent messengers to get her, she came to him, and he slept with her. Then she went back home. The action is quick. David sees, he sends, he takes, he has sex with her, she goes. There's no love, no affection, no tenderness, no words, no relationship. Just lust. Adultery. Or Bathsheba conceives. Her husband is out at the front fighting for his country. So David, to cover his tracks, arranges for Uriah to be murdered. The woman mourns. David marries her. The birth of the child is legitimized. And David's dirty secret is safe. Or is it? There are at least two witnesses. David's conscience and God himself. And neither remain silent. So as we come to Psalm 32, that is the background. This is where David is at, written after his adultery with Bathsheba. So what is David guilty? Well, there are three words here. And again, verses 1 and 2. Blessed is he whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered, and blessed is the man whose sin, the word is actually iniquity, later on it's translated as iniquity, down in verse 5, whose sin the Lord does not count against him, and in whose spirit is no deceit. Now, what is David guilty? Three words. Transgression, sin, iniquity. David is guilty of transgression. When he sees Bathsheba, God erects a sign. David, it's this way, not that way. Do not commit adultery. Says David, no chance. God's way leads nowhere. I'm going my way. And when he sends the Bathsheba, there's still time. David, this way. David says, I'm going my way. And when he contemplates the murder of a decent man, David, this way. Do not murder. I'm going my way. Transgression. Going my way, not God's way. And David is guilty of sin. The word in verse 1 means falling short, missing the mark. So what's the maximum score in darts? 180. But if you score less than 180, you've fallen short. Nothing wrong with the target. There's nothing wrong with God's target. God says, you shall love me with all your heart. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. But David takes a man's wife. Ultimately, he takes Uriah's life. Sin. And David is guilty. I say the word in verse 2 is translated as sin, but actually the word is iniquity. David is guilty of iniquity. It means to bend double. You think of the U-shaped bend on your lavatory. Okay? So every time you flush the loo, think of iniquity. All right? It means not being straight. Not being straight with God. But David gives to God a straight answer. But David is characterized by three words: transgression, sin, iniquity. But, says David, some people, verse 1, have had their transgressions forgiven. The sense of it is the weight has been lifted from them. And some, verse 1, have had their sins covered. Not a cover-up. But the matter's been dealt with, so that God's not going to bring it up again. And some, verse 2, though guilty of iniquity, have had the charges dropped. Far from being condemned by God, God says, you're free to go. This is David. Real happiness. Heaven's measure of happiness. Where is it to be found? Blessed is he whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man whose sin the Lord does not count against him. That's real happiness. And says David,
liar, adulterer, murderer. I know what I'm talking about. My friend, do you know what he's talking about? Well, point number two, putting it right. If David was guilty of such a wretched catalogue of sin, how did he put it right? Look at verses 3 to 5. After 9 months, David lives in denial. Oh, I'm sure he still reads his Bible, still goes to church, maybe even leads the people in prayer. But there's no communion with God. And David describes his experience in three ways. Verse 3, when I kept silence, living in denial, and pretending nothing has happened, when I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. So are there any arthritis sufferers here this morning? Knowing groans from somewhere. It's your bones have grown old, haven't they? So every step is painful. You get into a chair, it's, you get out of a chair, Well, David is suffering from spiritual arthritis. Every day he's groaning, sighing his way through the day. He's in pain. Nothing's right. And nothing dulls the pain. Verse 4, for day and night your hand was heavy upon me. And years ago I went on an outdoor pursuit course in the Breton Beacons. We set off all very cheerily about 8 in the morning. These great big heavy packs on our back. That's the town packs on our back. And as we climbed and climbed and climbed, and as the sun began to blaze down upon us, and we climbed and we climbed and we climbed, the sun was blazing down upon us, my pack grew heavier and heavier and heavier. And I would have given anything to put it down. I couldn't, because we planned a ridiculous route that was about 20 miles. I just had to keep on going with this pack on my back. Well, that's David, isn't it? He's exhausted under this weight of guilt. He'd do anything to put it down. But he can't put it down. He's pretending nothing's happened when I kept silent. Verse 4, my strength was sapped as in the heat of summer. And I've lived in Australia, in Perth, in the winter, paddock was covered with this luscious green grass, beautiful. But in summer drought, the grass turns brown and it's tinder dry. It's as though the very life has been sucked out of it. The very life has been sucked out of David. He's not the man he was. There's a fire burning. There's a fire of his conscience burning in his bones. He's a man drained of life. My friend, you know what David is saying? What are you like when you're in pain? I'm ratty. I'm quick with people. When we're in pain, we groan, don't we? And you? You're ratty. You're quick with people. You get angry over little things. You find yourself blaming other people. Maybe the real cause is spiritual arthritis. When I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. Maybe the only one to blame is you. And like David, you're living in denial. And your personal history goes with us wherever we go, doesn't it? Maybe you wish you could turn the clock back. Things you've done, places you've been, situations, things that have happened. And you wish you could turn the clock back, but you can't. And it's your personal history. And it's logged somewhere. And you just carry it around with you. And sometimes it's like a dead weight. But maybe it's not your personal history that's weighing heavy upon you. Maybe it's God's hand that is pressing down upon you. But day and night, your hand was heavy upon me. like David, you're living in denial. And maybe you're not what you were. Christian friend, when you might have been bearing fruit by the armful, your spiritual life is now small and mean and thin. And it's dying. And in spiritual terms, you've lost weight. You've lived off the fat of yesterday's blessings for too long. My strength was sapped as in the heat of summer. But like David, you're living in denial. There's nothing to say when I catch silence. My friend, are you like David? Well, how did David put things right? Well, you can read about it through 2 Samuel chapter 12, through the prophet Nathan. God outs David's sin. Not a secret anymore, David. It's known. Heaven knows. And David does what he should have done a long, long time ago. Verse 3, when I kept silent. So now, verse 5, it's time to speak. Then, 9 months of denial, 9 months of spiritual arthritis, 9 months of God's hand heavy upon me, 9 months of the spiritual life being sapped, drained out of me. Then I acknowledged my sin to you and did not cover up my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord. What does David do? David comes clean. Tells God everything. Confesses it all. What does David discover? Verse 5. And you forgave the guilt of my sin. Calm of sins forgiven. David confessed. David didn't say it was sexual desire. Lord, it was sinful desire. I know the landscape is scattered with the wreckage of broken lives and broken relationships. Psalm 51, what does David pray? Lord, against you, you only have I sinned and done this evil in your sight. And though for 9 months, no doubt, David's been worrying about his reputation. What are people going to say? Lord, the only thing that matters is what you say. Hating his sin, David comes clean. He tells God everything. Have you done? Have you owned up? Then I acknowledged my sin to you. Have you given God a straight answer and did not cover up my iniquity? Have you confessed to God what you've done? I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord. Then we put things right. Well, someone's thinking, hang on a minute. It's all very well David doing that and David being forgiven. This is a man who takes another man's wife. This is a man who then takes that man's life itself to cover his tracks. Can David just be forgiven like that? How can God let him off? My friend, God's blessings rest upon people like David. God's blessings rest on sinners because of something God himself has done. Now the Bible tells us that Jesus Christ, God's Son, he went to a cross. And if David's transgressions were lifted from him, it was because they were placed on Jesus. And if David's sin was dealt with, it was because another took the blame. And if David's iniquity wasn't charged to him, it was, says the Bible, because it was charged to Jesus. And so when God came to punish the guilty, Jesus took the blame. And justice was done. Those sins were dealt with. God did punish them. God met the full cost of David's forgiveness himself in the death of his son. And because Christ died, the sinner can go free. The sin of Jesus Christ washed away David's sin. Which is why every sinner who comes clean falls on the arms of Jesus, discovers the happiness of sins forgiven. Blessed is he whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. Well, we come to our third point. We talked about real happiness in verses 1 and 2. We've seen how David put things right in verses 3 to 5. Let's just look now, finally, at verses 6 to 11, at the happy life. Now, my friend, on the other side of that door marked forgiveness, you'll find three things. The first is this, safety. Look at verses 6 and 7. Therefore, says David, let everyone who is godly pray to you while you may be found. Surely when the mighty waters rise, they will not reach him. You are my hiding place. You will protect me from trouble and surround me with songs of deliverance. Surely when the mighty waters rise, they will not reach him. We all think of the memory of the tsunami in Japan. And it's shocking, some of these waves as they hit the shore. They're 30 meters high, 100 feet. Difficult to imagine, isn't it? And we've seen the pictures of these mighty waters roaring in over the coast, over the fields, over the roads, carrying everything before them. Surely when the mighty waters rise, they will not reach it. But what's the greatest tsunami? What's the greatest flood you can think of? Well, surely it's in the days of Noah. In that day there was nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. There was no high ground, was there? Surely when the mighty waters rise, what was the flood? It was God's judgment upon a wicked humanity. Well, says David, in the judgment to come, when the mighty waters rise, I'll be safe. I'm a sinner who's safe. One of our girls, when she was converted, one of the first things she said, I'm safe. David says, when you're forgiven, you're safe. You're a sinner saved from hell. Surely when the mighty waters rise, they will not reach him. I remember seeing a film of a woman and a child clinging to a treetop. It's floods in Mozambique. And now the waters were raging below. An interview came a helicopter. It brought her and her child to safety. That's forgiveness. Being carried high above the floodwaters of God's judgment. So my friend, are you safe? Can you say, I'm safe? Or are you clinging to your treetop? Verse 7, you are my hiding place. You will protect me from trouble. In the American Civil War, a soldier, the fighter, Brewer, was killed. And in his pocket they found a poem. There's a poem that he'd written. I think about 9 verses to the poem. And the poem was called My Hiding Place. David says, you are my hiding place. I won't read out the whole poem, but these are the last 3 verses. What he wrote. Should storms of sevenfold thunder roll, and shake the globe from pole to pole, no flaming bolt could daunt my face, for Jesus is my hiding place. On him almighty vengeance fell, that would have sunk a world to hell. He bore it for the chosen race, thus became their hiding place. Few more rolling suns at most will land me on fair Canaan's coast, and I shall sing the song of grace, and see my glorious hiding place. I'm forgiven. I'm in Jesus. Safe in Jesus. His hiding place. When God comes to punish the guilty, will you have a hiding place in that day? And verse 7. David says, you'll surround me with songs of deliverance. Forgiven people sing. God has made his people a singing people. We have presence of churches in Sri Lanka. When I go to Sri Lanka, I've been involved in baptisms in the sea. And there, last summer, I think we had 48 baptisms in the sea. It was very wonderful. And they go in the water. Someone that's the first time ever been in the sea. They go in the water, we baptize them. And then as they come out of the water, it's like a sort of phalanx of all the believers. They're all standing there on the seashore. And they're all singing. They're all singing of songs of deliverance. And they're clapping their hands as well and singing. And they're singing that our brother, our sister is saved. They've been delivered. They've been washed clean from their sins. And the whole air is filled with wonder and joy. And some of those people have been guerrilla fighters. They've been Tamil tigers. They're guilty of atrocities. But they're surrounded by songs of deliverance. They're safe people. They're forgiven people. And Jesus has done it all. We sang it, didn't we? My sin, oh, the bliss of this glorious thought. My sin, not in part, but the whole, is nailed to his cross. And I bear it no more. Praise the Lord. Praise the Lord for my soul. You sing that? Friend, are you safe? Are you forgiven? Well, the second thing is, through that door marked forgiveness, what do you find? You find a relationship. Or in David's case, it's a relationship restored, isn't it? Look at verses 8 and 9 now. God himself is speaking. I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. I will counsel you and watch over you. Do not be like the horse or the mule. It's not David's counsel. God is speaking. Which have no understanding, which must be controlled by bit and bridle, or they will not come near to you. In those months of denial, David's been no smarter than a horse or a mule. Now, some days on my day off, on Monday I go for a walk in Buckinghamshire. Right part of the world, past various fields, and in those fields of horses. I call to the horses. Sometimes they come. They just come over, and pat them, and talk to them. And if you blow on their nostrils, and you go, quite like it. Sometimes they come. And sometimes they completely ignore me. I'm falling away for horses, and the horse is just completely ignoring me. Or even worse, you call the horse, and the horse goes even further away. Sometimes they come, sometimes they ignore me. For 9 months, God has been calling to David. But like a headstrong horse, he's been ignoring that call. Even more than that, he's been determined to go his own way. And like a stubborn mule, so the mule is don't you? He refuses to come. Until God has to get hold of him with bit and bridle and drag him near. And he says to David, never again. Do not be like the horse or the mule, which have no understanding, but must be controlled by bit and bridle, or they will not come near to you. Never again, David. No, David, we're father and son. Look at verse 8. I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. I will counsel you and watch over you. And then the third translation, which I like, catches it more. And the second part of verse 8 says, I will guide you with my eye. What God says to him, I'll guide you with my eye. So it's the guide someone with your eye, your teacher, or your parent. We guide our children with our eye, don't we? And look at us. And just a look in our eye, they think, no, I won't do it. Well, they look at us for reassurance, and just a look in our eye, we say, it's okay, just a look in our eye. We don't have to say a word. Nothing more needs to be said. We just look. We're guided by their eye. A reassuring look or a don't do it look. And David is saying, those who God forgive, they enjoy a relationship with God. A relationship of a father and a child. A relationship of intimacy, of love, of trust. Not only has to look at me. Not only have to to raise his voice or say a word. He only has to look at me. And I'm looking at him, and I know it's okay, I can do that. I won't do that. See his face. He guides me with his eye. He gently leads me. In this room, am I a child? Am I a child of God, guided with his eye? Just to look. That's all that's needed. I trust and obey because I'm a forgiven person. I have a relationship with him. Or am I like a horse? When God speaks, I pretend I don't hear. When God speaks, I raise a gallop away. Like a mule. Stubborn. Stupid. Digging my heels in. I have no understanding. And then the third thing. On the other side of that door marked forgiveness, says David, you'll find joy. Look at verses 10 and 11. We've come full circle, haven't we? Many are the woes of the wicked, but the Lord's unfailing love surrounds the man who trusts in him. Rejoice in the Lord and be glad, you righteous. Sing, all you who are upright in heart. And he speaks of joy. Because there is such a thing as the joy of sins forgiven, of being right with God. Why make it hard on myself? Many are the woes of the wicked. Many are the sorrows of the wicked. If you go that way, if you pretend there's nothing to talk with God about, I've no sin to confess, there's nothing to deal with, I'm going my way, many are the sorrows. Many are the woes of the wicked, but the Lord's unfailing love surrounds the man who trusts in him. Now, the word unfailing love, the word is hesed, it's called covenant love. It's a love of a bridegroom for his bride. The love which says, I'll never let you go. David can say, he never took his eye off me. He never let me go. When I was so far off, always within reach, brought me home again into the embrace of his love. And you can hear David saying, why ever did I go away? Why did I do it? Why? Because whatever the pleasures of sin, whatever the pleasures in that body shape, the pleasures of God are infinitely sweeter. Now I know. This is David, join with me. Come, join with me in the chorus, verse 11. Rejoice in the Lord and be glad, you righteous. Sing, all you who are upright in heart. Think of Alan Gardner, lover of Jesus Christ, who let's take the gospel across the world. He was marooned on a trip of South America in 1851, this is so. No way of communicating with anyone. There was marooned. And there they were. They were battered by Atlantic gales, weakened by cold and disease. They were now without food, without water. There was no prospect of rescue. And he was dying slowly. And he wrote down his thoughts in the remaining days of his life. So what were his final words? He wrote this. Marvelous kindness for me, sinner. Died a happy man, a forgiven man. Because blessed, happy is he whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are pardoned. It's time to close. We've opened up the psalm. Talked about the joy of sins forgiven. We left out half a verse. Did you spot it? What did we leave out? Look at verse 2. Blessed is the man whose sin the Lord does not count against him, and in whose spirit is no deceit. What does David mean? David had been deceiving himself. The happy man is the man whose spirit there is no deceit. for 9 months or more, there was deceit in David. And he'd been deceiving himself. David has been guilty. He's been living in denial. Is that you? Christian friend, is that you? Are you this morning living in denial? Is there something in your life, and it may have been going on for 9 days, 9 months, maybe 9 years, and you're not straight with God? And when you pray, you can bring the 99% of your life before God, but this 1% or 5% or 10% or whatever it is, you never bring to Him. And you're living in denial. And actually the whole of your life is actually turning on that 1%. Because it's the very thing you will not bring to Him. Are you living in denial? Is there some long-rooted sin and you're not dealing with it? And you see you have all sorts of words to cover it, don't you? So you might say, well, it's their problem, not mine. Or you say, well, it was the way I was brought up. Well, things have been very difficult recently. And if you were in my shoes, you would have done the same. And actually, there was no alternative. It was the only thing I could have done under the circumstances. But you see, it's a family thing. You know, my mother was like that. My father was like that. It's just the hand I've been dealt. And it's a family trait. It's always been a problem. Just the way I am. Or someone said to me, there are far worse things. Why are you getting at me? Why are you picking on me? Christian was saying, why are you picking on me? There are other people who do far worse things. People say. And if things are making your sin uncomfortable, what if there was no comeback? What if you knew you'd carry on for another 9 months, another 9 years, and there was no comeback, you'd get away with it? Would you carry on? Christian friend, do you hate your sin? Are you dealing with it? Or are you living in denial? And that's why God's hand is heavy upon you. And that's why you're cranky and scratchy and ratty and quick with God's people. And you're always looking sideways. And you're always finding fault with somebody else. Maybe that's to say to you, you have no understanding. You're like a brute beast. Maybe you read your Bible, you pray. But it's a joyless Christianity, isn't it? You grind your teeth through this Christianity. Because it says, many are the woes of the wicked. The Christian friend, is that you? David writes this as a believer. It's perfectly possible for a believer to fall into these things. And him who thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. Is that you? Why ever are you keeping away? And did Jesus endure all this for me? Did he go to a cross? Did he shed his blood? Was he crowned with thorns? Was he crowned with the curse? Was it all for me? For me now to close my heart to him. Stop living in denial. Stop being that horse who won't come. Stop being that mule who's digging in his feelings. Take that 1% that you haven't prayed about for how many years have it been? That one thing you will never bring to him and haven't brought to him. It's time to bring it to him. You know what to do. David has told you. Then I acknowledged my sin to you and did not cover up my iniquity. Give God a straight answer. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. My friend, this morning, if you're not a believer, what have you done? You've gone your own way, haven't you? and you've fallen short of God's command. You never loved God with all your heart. You never loved your neighbor as yourself. You're guilty of sin. And you've never given to God a straight answer. Iniquity. What does it mean? It means you stand condemned. The Bible says you're on a collision course. On a collision course with God's anger. And hell is more real than you dare think. Many are the woes of the wicked. If you die unforgiven, there is no remedy. And God will punish you forever. And your woes and your sorrows will be endless. But God is near. God is near and is ready to hear. Speak to him. Look at verse 6. There's a lovely word there. Therefore, let everyone who is godly pray to you while you may be found. And God can be found this morning. God is near. Every time his word is open, God is near. And he's been waiting for so long to hear you call to him. Call him by name. So come to him. Come to the place of forgiveness. Come to the cross. Come to Jesus Christ. It's the place where burdens are lifted. It's the place where sins are taken away. All upon the kind arms of Jesus. God, be merciful to me, sinner.